Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
What's on the mind of Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics? On Donald Trump, has he cut his foot off finally, destroyed himself with a ridiculous tweet? And what's going on at Francis W. Parker School and Project Veritas and the controversy there around, pardon me, butt plugs? We're going to have Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics, as our guest on the Chicago Way. And Jeff Carlin is here as always, co-host, WGN producer, executive producer, future physics teacher. If you need to make a crust, bake a crust, he's the man to call. And I'm John Cass, editor-in-chief of your most favorite website. So our second favorite website, depending on where Bevin is on this, to johncassnews.com. And we're beginning an advertising push, so I hope it works out. And where are you with the lack of clergy on the steps of Francis W. Parker Elite School and Donald Trump saying that we should get rid of the Constitution because it gets in the way of his politics or political ambitions? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
And our guest is the great Tom Bevin of Real Clear Politics, co-founder and president of your second favorite or first favorite website, because they put everything out there from the left and the right, just like Twitter promises to be and just like newspapers used to be. Welcome to the Chicago Way, Tom Bevin.
Always great to be with you, boys.
Great to have you, Tom. How's the poll accountability project going? I keep seeing headlines about it.
Yeah, we wanted to wait till the runoff was finished. Mm-hmm. And so we're putting the finishing touches on it. We'll release it probably next week, I think. Cool. It's already Thursday, so I think we'll I can tell you, you know, looking at the numbers, I mean, it's pretty much what people thought. I mean, Trafalgar did not have a great cycle. You know, it had some big misses in some of these states where, particularly in the blue states where Lee Zeldin, he thought was ahead, or not ahead, but close. Patty Murray out in Washington, Colorado and Michigan were sort of the big misses. Insider Advantage, not a great cycle for them. And meanwhile, I think the most accurate pollster of the cycle was CNN, and Fox News was good. Marist, New York Times, Siena all had pretty good cycles. Survey USA, I think, was up there. So, again, we'll see, you know, what the report card shows. And then we're going to also obviously include that as part of their overall performance for the last few cycles, because you can't just look at this and say, well, I mean, obviously Trafalgar had a bad cycle this time. They had a couple of misses in 2018, but in 2016 and 2020, they were among the most accurate. So they're going to get rated for their performance in this cycle, but also over the last four or five cycles.
That'll be that. That's interesting because that's the stuff that I think most people. Well, I don't think in real time people probably don't process it quick enough. But like looking back and be like, well, I voted this way, and what was how was I influenced, and thinking about that will even be more powerful, I think, for people for looking at polls in the future. So that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Tom Bevin in his office, like behind a huge desk in some building, you know, some downtown building, and everyone's on the phone. His secretary keeps rushing in saying, now we've got this guy on the phone and that guy, all these pollsters calling saying, hey, Tom, trying to mitigate the report that's coming out. You getting any pressure from your?
Not quite like that.
Really?
No, I mean,
come on, it's got to be.
They call them executive assistants nowadays. Look,
the numbers are the numbers. I mean, what can mitigate, you know, the actual reality of the numbers? I mean, it's not something you can really fudge on, right?
Context.
Well, I mean, what context is there? I mean, the criteria, obviously. Look, one of the things that you know, one of the criteria that we put on this is there's a cutoff date, right? We're not judging pollsters on the accuracy of polls that were released a month or 2 months or 3 months before the election. I mean, that's not serious. Now, however, I mean, that's part of, I think, one of the problems is that you get these pollsters and some polls that will come out a month before the election or 6 weeks before the election and show, you know, some crazy number that drives a narrative about a race that you know, someone's up or someone's down or whatever. And that's, I think, a bit of a problem as well. Even if that polling operation, you know, their next poll, subsequent poll or two polls later, you know, sort of come in line with where the race actually is or they show different results. So that's something that, you know, we don't really get a chance to touch on. But it certainly is an issue that we see out there, which is, you know, these polls, they drive media coverage, they drive narratives, and some of the polls that do that, unfortunately, are not accurate. But again, you know, the pollster can respond, well, it's, you know, it was 2 months before the election, and that's where the race is. Right. This is just a snapshot in time, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a tricky proposition.
I happen to think that it's a brilliant design on your part and on Real Clear Politics part, because the polls are integral to Real Clear and you are calling them to account, the pollsters to account. And I just think that in the interest of transparency, very interesting and very, my hat's off to you. I do tip the hat.
Well, thank you.
Indeed. I second that. Yeah, that's a great thing. I mean, I think more people know and can understand what they're being told, and that is more powerful than anything. I mean, so hooray, Tom. Thanks for saving the Republic or doing at least doing your part.
Well, listen.
Now, when are you going to be the president of Twitter?
When am I going to be the president of Twitter? Elon and I are in discussions. I will be the deputy twit. How's that?
There you go.
He's the chief twit. I'm the deputy twit.
We were told by our dads years ago that men don't twit. We don't want to be twitters, but I guess now we do. Everyone does, right?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, this entire thing that's happening now with since Musk purchased Twitter and has been running it and doing, you know, the Twitter files and all this, that suddenly the shoe is on the other foot, and you know, liberals are like, oh, we can't have a billionaire controlling speech this way. And he's just sitting back there behind his desk, you know, whimsically making up rules and deciding whose voices get heard, right, and whose don't. It's like, I mean, where have they been for years? Meanwhile, you know, conservatives are on the other side are encouraging this and enjoying it and feel like it's really, you know, that he is restoring free speech. I mean, it's not without, I always thought, you know, it is a tricky, trying to regulate speech in any way, whether it's the government or private entities, is really hard. I mean, it's just a really, because you get in these situations where slippery slopes are everywhere, everywhere you look. Mm-hmm. And Twitter certainly found itself in that position pre Elon Musk. But I've always said, you know, for me personally, I'm not a free speech absolutist, but I am strongly in favor of free speech, and I'd rather err on the side of free speech as opposed to erring on the side of censorship or suppression. And so I think generally what Musk is doing is good and is, you know, is helpful, even if it's sending some of the liberal folks into a bit of a tailspin.
The tweet that you put out, I mean, part of the magic of Twitter is you can just put out an opinion or take and offer a different take on things. And you did this a few days ago, and I wrote a whole column about it, basically crediting you with your tweet.
Thank you very much.
With your tweet on those who hadn't seen it, Tom tweeted out, never forget, or lest we forget, the media sucking up to Michael Avenatti. Lest we forget. And I thought, you know, that's it. It's just sometimes.
I'm guilty of that. I mean, we booked him on all the time. I got his cell phone, texted him a few times. So I'm guilty.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Jeff,
I've never had him on. What are you talking about?
No, not on this podcast, but I had him on WGN. Yeah, but right. I mean, a different, you know. I have to follow the trends of the day, so I follow the cover of that because we have to be interesting. But
opposed to this one, yeah.
Wait, come on now. That's not what I mean. We have to be interesting to more people, a much wider audience. So
you can't dig yourself out of this one.
No, I can't.
What was it like to call it? To call
it? He was weird. I mean, he was. Yeah, it was always sketchy. You know, he talked in like half sentences, which was a big red flag. And but he would say crazy stuff. I mean, and that's what we wanted. We wanted headlines. We wanted people to keep listening. And he was hot at the time. There's certainly obviously that hasn't been touched. You know, he's person non grata for a while now. Once everything started coming forward, is how terrible a person he is. So I mean that for what it is, and you know he would grab clicks. You know, people would just see his name on anything, and those stories are. Posts on our website would do really well. I mean, it's a corporate enterprise, and that was our mission. Our mission wasn't necessarily to be the most
eyeballs.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's part of the problem for everybody. But
absolutely,
yeah. Look, I mean, in fairness to me, my tweet was never forget how the media slobbered over this lowlife. The thing about Avenatti, yes, too, is that you know. When he first burst on the scene, I was looking to find out who this guy was, and there were stories out there. I mean, this guy was sketchy to begin with. I mean, this is not a guy who came onto the scene without, you know, previous baggage. He had taken a company called Tully's Coffee, and he had been being sued because he took the money that was supposed to be set aside, that companies set aside to pay, you know, FICA benefits. He had embezzled that. And then he basically shut the company down. He just like closed the doors one day. The employees had nowhere to go. I mean, he was not a good dude. And just you know, anybody who took the time to Google his name would have seen these stories. He was already involved in lawsuits, but the media didn't even do that. I mean, this is, you know, the media gets sucked in by these charlatans and these frauds. When you look at Sam Bankman-Fried, you look at, you know, Elizabeth Holmes, but at least in their case, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried, sort of this young guy. I mean, he wasn't really involved in anything sketchy prior to this. Elizabeth Holmes, kind of the same thing. I mean, she created this persona that managed to swindle, you know, even people like Henry Kissinger and all of these, you know, all of these very experienced and you know, prestigious people. That was not Michael Avenatti. I mean, he was a dirtbag from the jump, and the media just did not care about that because he was doing exactly what they wanted done, which was, you know, someone out there who was virulently, relentlessly attacking Donald Trump and trying to bring him down. And so they looked past everything and you know, we ended up finding out, or they ended up finding out, who this guy really was. And he was, like I said, he was a dirtbag from the get-go.
You know, I know this is a family podcast, so I have to guard the next sentence, but
listen, you don't want to get that explicit rating on Apple iTunes or something?
No, we don't.
I saw all the, you know, the mashups or media mashups about all the media personalities sucking up shamelessly to Avenatti. Reminded me of, I'll use a Yellowstone theme, okay? A bunch of mares in heat on the prairie wickering when the stallion comes by. I mean, that's how embarrassing it was. And I think that infection is made it clear that there's no repair for American media, at least not for many, many years. My opinion.
I agree with that. I mean, I think, there will be, this is not the last time we're going to see something like this where the media sort of, is enthralled by somebody who basically confirms their priors, right? Who is telling the narrative, or giving voice to the narrative that they want and they believe. So, I mean, other than the fact that, as I said, this is a guy who came to this, and he was just not a good guy from the beginning. There was ample evidence out there that this guy was just a complete charlatan and a fraud. I mean, he stole money from like a paraplegic.
Yeah, that's a terrible story.
It's like the worst of the worst. And yet the media just kind of was like, oh, okay, whatever, you know, let's continue to book him.
Well, Jeff think Carlin. Of it. I think of the good side that Brian Stelzer, who's now teaching journalism apparently with an old friend of mine at Harvard, he's
teaching a course on disinformation.
Maybe he can call Jeff as a panelist on his in his classroom.
Jeff.
We thought I was the one who was going to get the thumb screws today, and it turns out it's Jeff.
Now that you bring it up, okay, there's a couple issues that of local import that we have to get to, and one of national. The Tom Bevan, I'm told, knows something about Evanston, and I just want, what is the Evanston reaction to the reparations? My friend Steve the pilot knows that you're on, and he said you got to ask Bevan this. So what about the push by Daniel Biss, mayor of Evanston, white leftist progressive, wanting money from taxpayers to pay for the sins of the past?
Well, I mean, that's more of a guaranteed income situation that Biss is proposing, right? That's a, they're going to give out, what, $500 a month or $1,000 a month or something for some period of time. That's like a different situation than reparations. And, the Evanston reparations program was, I believe, the first of its kind, although you've seen other cities, and I'm trying to remember, I just saw in the news the other day, it was like, maybe it was Rhode Island, the state of Rhode Island, something like that. And then you had this news, Gavin Newsom's commission that he formed to study reparations came out with this, what was it? It was like $550 billion paying reparations to this is just for California. This is not nationally. And I think it's becoming a bigger and bigger thing. I think it's going to be part of the discussion of 2024, and it continues to be, even though it is fraught with all sorts of issues. It's not a hugely popular thing nationally, although it is popular among, Democrats and particularly progressives. But in terms of coming to some sort of workable reparations program nationally, it's going to be very, very difficult to do. And I think it'll be unpopular, but it's not going to stop these localities, these ultra liberal localities like Evanston and others, from doing their bit, you know, to right the wrongs of the past as they see it. Even if the one in Evanston has been, you know, there have been criticisms of it in how they went about, you know, structuring it and who was getting the money and all of that. And even then it was sort of a tiny amount in the grand scheme of things. So, but there's no question that reparations is going to continue to be part of the discussion moving forward, and maybe even a greater part of the discussion, because that's what, you know, because of what we're seeing in some of these cities around the country.
And to be clear, the Evanston program was one where it was designed where people were proving either through tax records or family history that they had property and weren't given access to government programs at the time.
Housing discrimination, and you had to live in the city since like 1969 or something. Exactly. And there were, $25,000.
Yeah, the max I think was 50 if they applied. And there were some people who were like, I don't need this money, but it's still going to be like given to me, and like, I don't want it. Because they for many reasons thought that it was, you know, unfair. And it was the first in the country, and you've seen it pop up in Delaware. But it's the amounts in tracking this stuff is, like you said, it's going to be almost impossible to make it a feasible system at a large scale. And it's not going to be popular in most of the country. I mean, it's just not. But
that, I don't know that that's going to stop Democrats from pushing it at you know, the national level. But we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about it. That Project Veritas issue, where at Francis Parker, some dean is talking about how excited the dean is with passing around butt plugs and
No offense, John, but hearing you say that those words is not.
I don't know.
There goes the
G-rating. It was hard enough for me to hard enough for me to discuss mayor's wickering stallion, but now to talk about butt plugs.
No, there it is again. Francis
Parker. Here's the thing. I don't want to oppose anyone's expression of their sexuality, but
right, I get
that. In school, I think among children, and I'm a Christian, right.
Underage so, children.
Suffer the little children unto me, said Jesus. And this is December, that we're getting into Christmas. If you did something like this, talked about this nonsense in Dearborn, Michigan, there would be six imams on the steps of Francis Parker pulling the dean's hair as they pulled him out into the street. This in Chicago, I ask you both this question. Has the church, and by the church I mean Christian church, but also rabbis and imams and other clerics, but particularly Roman Catholics, and in my case, the Greek metropolitan, who's a friend of mine, I wonder, where are they in all this stuff? Has the church lost moral authority? And how is that going to manifest itself over the next few years?
Go ahead, Jeff. You first.
I'm sorry.
No. I mean, okay. So the story is that, correct me if I'm, you know, clipping anything here. Project Veritas or Veritas, depending on your pronunciation, undercover has a dean apparently from Francis
Dean Parker, of students.
Dean of students on tape, and here's some of what they're saying. And this is just something I tweeted. Tom, you retweeted this. It's pretty appalling. So for any younger listeners, for younger listeners.
Earmuffs.
For children, yeah.
Our LGBTQ+ health center come in. They were passing around butt plugs and dildos to my students, talking about queer sex, using lube versus using spit.
Meet Joe Bruno, dean of students at the prestigious Francis W. Parker Private School in Chicago, which happens to charge $40,000 per student.
They're just like passing around dildos, butt plugs. The kids are just playing with them. They're like, how does this work? How does this work? That's a really like cool part of my job.
Parents might be stunned to learn that Bruno's version of love and acceptance means handing out sex toys to underage students.
And it goes on from there. I don't know if I'm going to play the whole thing here, but that's it's a clearly ridiculously appalling. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I mean, but you can note that every time there was there's a lot of up jump cuts, as you call it in the business. So it's being taken either cut tightly out of context or whatever. We're not getting the full picture of what's being said. I mean, this guy, he's talking about this group coming in and doing this. He could have gone on and say, for all we know, and it was a disaster and it will never happen again. And I was, you know, embarrassed by it, but we don't get that exactly in context. Just saying it as an editor, someone who edits stuff for a living, you could easily make the case either way on it. Now they put out the full tape and they probably will. It'll be this long 30-minute piece and we'll see it first in context. But just for heads up, Varitas does do stuff like that and have been caught editing tapes and people have rebuked what they've said in the past. So that being said, it's insanely disturbing
to me. That being said, even that clip, you know, out of context, right, is appalling.
Right.
Look, I don't, I mean, this is like one of those shocked, not shocked things.
Right, exactly.
But he did say in there that these were 14 to 18 year old kids. Mm. So these were not like, you know, little kids, tiny, tiny kids, but nevertheless, it's like, you know, and I suppose the school would defend that, or the dean would defend that by saying, well, it's a sex ed class. You know, they're learning about sex. And he says in here, queer sex. It's like, well, okay. But, you know, we've moved on from the days of when we were taught sex ed in class, which is like, you know, here are the parts and here's what they do. And
here's that's a banana.
Yeah. I mean, it's like
a condom on it and then you're good.
I'd blush throughout the whole thing, thinking sure of Pamela Tiffin and pink cashmere sweater. I couldn't handle it.
And this is the part of it that is, I think, most disturbing to most people, which is the aggressiveness with which,
yes,
this stuff and these, you know, alternative lifestyle choices, whatever euphemism you want to use, is being pushed in classrooms. You see, I mean, if you go on Libs of TikTok and you see all of these educators that are, you know, decorating their classes with pride flags. And I mean, it's just like, it is on some level, an indoctrination. And it's kind of like, you know, for me, it's like, it's not that I don't want my kids to learn about that stuff, but I want to be the one to tell. It's not the job. I want teachers to teach my kids how to read and write and do math and science and leave some of that other stuff. Yeah. You know, especially when we're talking about, you know, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, where they're, you know, rewriting Cinderella with different pronouns and all these things. It's like, that is not necessary or even appropriate for kids of that age. And so it's just another example of, you know, how you've seen this, this aggressiveness with which this agenda has been pushed all the way down into the youngest grades of elementary school. And it's a problem.
I'm just looking at my Twitter feed and people saying, we used to like you, John Cass, but now you're a terrible human being, despicable. You've fallen so low, scraping the bottom of the barrel.
For what?
For retweeting this. And I think that's what bothers me. That not that people have different opinions from me, but that
you're a bad person for having your opinion.
No, the anger and the rapid response team of the hard left on this issue is not really good for the hard left or the rest. I just think.
Well, that's certainly, I mean, if you're on social media, I mean, that's what you're going to get. Right. That's where all of the folks are, yeah, you know, well, populated.
Right. I mean, it's what form are you using there? And I agree with you. I mean, Tom, especially the idea of teaching this stuff or even broaching it at such a young age, it's just It does not make sense to me. I don't have kids, so I throw that caveat out there that we'll take it for what it's worth. My concern about it, especially somebody who's looking to become a teacher, is it's the idea of, okay, I appreciate that you want to have representation for some minority group, which in this case is, people under the LGBTQ+ umbrella. But that's, even in reported numbers, and if you want to, extrapolate this number out to say people who aren't responding to data because they're afraid or whatever, they aren't part of mainstream media, they don't have housing, whatever it is, undercut the numbers, you could duplicate the numbers by 100% and still be only like 16% of the population. So you take it as what it's worth. It's like 10% of the population, maybe. But there's this like over representation necessary for some reason, because why? I mean, I get the idea people want to, people come in all stripes and you want to make sure people feel like aren't slapped in the face by reality when they come across it as adults and like, oh, I didn't know this even existed. Sure. But we're talking about like the raw numbers. You're overrepresenting it as something that people are going to be like, well, you're going to come across it every day of your life. And so you should maybe even think about it. Like, it just feels very forced.
Yeah, but these things are not unconnected or disconnected. I mean, the number of people who are identifying as LGBTQ, or sure, trans, right, is thousands of percentages mm-hmm. higher than it was 20 years ago, because right. it's being, pushed and fed to right. to these kids on TikTok and mm-hmm. other social media. And suddenly, being a tomboy is no longer, that means suddenly you're right. a boy trapped in a girl's body and you need, right. Top surgery and stuff. I mean, it's just so
the decisions are irrevocable.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, for yeah, but children. I mean, it's a cultural phenomenon, and it's not
the pet rock theory.
And it's the agenda that's being pushed is helping to drive the numbers of people who are identifying that way up. I mean, I think there's right. an absolute correlation there. So, and I think that's been part of the plan from the beginning. And again, my gripe is just the aggressiveness and how this is being pushed in schools all the way down to, yes. to kindergarten and first grade. It's like,
yeah.
I just want my kids to learn how to read. Right. I can, when right. the time is right, I can, my wife and I will teach them about,
or
the birds and the bees and butt plugs and all that stuff.
Or we'll call on Governor Pritzker, to hold a seminar for them.
Well, yeah.
In the meantime, we have another issue, and I have to get to it before I can sense Jeff's concern that we've kept you so long, and we have. But, okay, another issue that we got need Tom Bevin's take on it, and it doesn't have anything to do with the Cocaine Bear movie.
Yes.
The question is, has Donald Trump irrevocably destroyed himself in the matter of the Twitter files, where he comes out in a tweet on Truth Social and writes about how we got to get rid of the massive, he says Twitter files vindicates his position with respect to the 2020 election and wants to get rid of the Constitution. I don't get it. Where is the gain for Trump in this thing? I see it only as a loss, and like so many other things that he's done, it's like basically encouraging people to walk away from him.
I totally agree with that. I mean, this was obviously the dinner with Kanye and Nick Fuentes was a disaster. Yeah. But this one was
even more so.
Even more so, in the sense that the Twitter files come out, and it, effectively he could have tweeted, and I tweeted about this, what he should have said,
right?
Which is, here's more proof that I was right about 2020 and big tech colluded with the Democrats to suppress the Hunter Biden story and help rig it for Joe, right? Instead, what he said was, this massive fraud, we need to suspend all the rules and regulations, including those in the Constitution. And just
a fit.
Inexplicable, self-inflicted wound, which to your point, John, for those people who are out there, and then, you know, I had some people on Twitter saying, oh, that's not what he said. You know, it is exactly what he said. Mm-hmm. And all of these people who are trying to like cover for Trump and say, oh, that's not what he said. That's not what he meant. Read it again. Take a reading class. You know, did you fail reading comprehension in third grade? Like all his little jabs. Yeah. No, he said what he said. And I think it was clear to everybody. But for those folks who like Trump's policies, but don't want to deal with Trump, I mean, it's just another reason to look elsewhere. And he's had a couple of those in the last couple of weeks, in addition to, you know, what happened on November 8th. I think if there had been a red wave, if Republicans had won, you know, significantly more seats in the House and won a Senate seat or two, it would be a different conversation. But mm-hmm. but Trump has been weakened by that. And I think the alternatives to Trump are emboldened, and I would not be surprised. I mean, you can see it happening all around you, all these folks that are sort of dipping their toes in the water and taking another look at it. And we'll see what Ron DeSantis decides to do, because obviously he's the biggest threat to Trump waiting in the wings. But yeah, I think Trump it's been a really bad few weeks for him. And the question is, you know, has he mortally wounded himself? And
yes.
Well, I mean, listen, having watched Donald Trump survive, yeah, like 72 mortal wounds over the last 6 years, like, I'm not ready to just call it just yet. Okay.
I pronounced him dead after the Megyn Kelly thing, and I was wrong. And I thought he was dead before Rand Paul, who was my candidate, but I like Trump's policies. I don't like the man. Am I really odd?
You're not alone. I mean, there are plenty of folks out there that share that view. But I'm just saying, as a practical matter, I'm not willing to pronounce Donald Trump dead until he's officially dead, politically speaking. But that doesn't mean that he hasn't hurt himself significantly and opened himself up to legitimate challenges from people who will come out and when I say legitimate challenges, I'm not talking about like John Bolton, who's going to get it, you know, it's like, or Larry Hogan, who's, I mean, it's just, by legitimate people who could give him a potential run for his money. Right now, that seems to be Ron DeSantis is the only one who sort of fits in that category, but I think it's an evolving situation, and we'll see how it goes.
He's a tragic figure, and even if you like him or not like him, I adopt the VDH, Victor Davis Hanson, view of Trump as the tragic figure here. Yeah, he'll be alone, and he will be jabbering away and demanding people listen to him, and the American people will have turned away from him.
Yeah, but
that's how I see it.
But here's the problem, John. I mean, this is why it presents just a problem for Republicans. Do you think Donald Trump, do you think he's going to go quietly? Do you think if he loses the nomination to Ron DeSantis, he's just going to turn around and endorse Ron DeSantis and be like, hey, Republicans need to get together and because we have to defeat them? No. And I don't know what the number is. Is it 5% of the Republican base? Is it 20% of the Republican base? Hardcore Trump supporters who are going to be pissed that he lost. And when he tells them, you know, screw the Republican Party, screw these guys, you know, don't go vote for them or whatever he's going to say. I mean, who knows what he's going to say? He could announce a third party run and be like, I'm going to go, you know, it's not going to be good for Republicans. It is not going to be good if he doesn't win the nomination. It's not going to be good for Republicans if he does win the nomination. So I think they're in a real
catch 22.
You know, you heard about weekend at Bernie's, the dead man, for a weekend.
Yeah.
We'll have 4 years of Joe Biden, whether he's dead or not. Whether he's living or not, sentient being or not, we'll have him, you know, because of this.
Well,
my gosh.
It's going to be a very interesting next, you know, 2 years as Republicans work their way through this and see how they can or if they can sort of, you know, leave or extricate themselves from Donald Trump, because he is the biggest, you know, most dominant member of the party right now. And like I said, he's just not going to go quietly. I mean, I, Maybe he will. I mean, you never know.
What if he runs for governor of Florida just to still be in the state? And that satiates him. And that's like Florida, his own domain, his dominion. Because he could get any law passed there.
Even if he gets indicted, you know, by the January 6th committee or whatever, that's only going to make him stronger. I mean, it's only going to galvanize his supporters more closely to him and make it more difficult for the party to move on to another figure. So it's just a really tricky situation for Republicans and Democrats have their own issues. I mean, it's putting Joe Biden up again, as you mentioned, is not necessarily a slam dunk either. So
just the thought of it.
Ugh. I just want to build a wall around me and maybe have a nice little pond or a statue of St. Francis in there, even though I'm Greek Orthodox, and have the wall keep us separate from the world, like the Benedictine option, right?
Why don't you retire and move to Greece? Go to the homeland. Get away from
it. What, and hang with the commies? No way. That's why did my parents come here, you know, to get away from those left wingers? And now all my friends from Poland and Czechoslovakia and others who worked their ass off to get here are seeing that the United States is becoming rather socialist in its at least its aspirations. So Tom Bevin, I guess you're going to see the cocaine bear, right? You're going to take the kids.
I saw a headline on that. I have no idea what that is.
It's a perfect movie, man.
I'm probably going to have to sit down and watch Harry and Meghan with my wife. The Netflix.
Oh my God! Wait, stop!
Stop the presses! I made news.
Wow, you are dedicated, sir. I appreciate
that. Wow. What can you extract?
You know, so my wife is like, she loves the royal family and the whole thing I'm not a big royal person, but I am fascinated by how Meghan and Harry have managed to go from a situation where they were among the most adored, loved, respected folks with all of the accoutrements of royal life, and turn themselves into the most hated, the least respected, the money grubbing, publicity seeking couple that seems to be willing to do anything to, you know, make a buck, even at the expense of their family and the institution and all these things. I mean, it's really remarkable. I mean, it really is fascinating to me. So I figure I got to see it for myself. As opposed to just watching reading stories about the clips and whatnot. So it's a fascinating social phenomena, in my opinion.
If you have to see Meghan and Harry, whatever the damn show is, I guess I'll have to see it too. Because
we can talk about it on the next podcast.
To keep peace in this world, because Betty loves what I call Cinderella Princess competition, which is the ice skating in Olympic ice skating. And so this is, of course, a natural response. But Cocaine Bear.
Well, yes.
That will save me.
All right. This is the last subject. All right. I get to be the host. I'm asking the exit question here. Who do you have winning the World Cup, John? I know you're a big fan of soccer. You follow this stuff closely. Who do you have?
France.
France.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll find out Saturday.
We will France find out. England. We will find out Saturday. All right. I wouldn't mind that. I mean, Brazil's a favorite, right? Like heavy favorite or just favorite?
Heavy favorite. Too, right? I wouldn't mind England winning because they invented the English game, you know, and I love it. Takes stamina to play the 4-4 bleeping two.
Well, given that I always root for the underdog, I'm pulling for Morocco.
Oh, that was
nice.
Now you got me going. Heroic, epic. What can I say?
All right. Well, we'll know soon enough.
Indeed.
Tom Bevin, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, guys.
Love you. Talk to you soon. Thank you, sir. Bye.
Bye.
Why did you want to make this documentary? No one sees what's happening behind the closed doors. I had to do everything I could to protect my family.
When the stakes are this high, doesn't it make more sense to hear our story from us?
For Tom Bevin, co-founder, president of Real Clear Politics, my friend, and the man who tried to get me to run for mayor of Chicago. So I guess he really isn't my friend. And Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, co-host here as always, master of pies, master of cats, and me, John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of your favorite place for Midwestern common sense, johncassnews.com. Thanks for joining us on the Chicago Way, and join us again, won't you, next time, when we'll be talking politics, common sense, and maybe that Cocaine Bear movie. See ya.